the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network presents Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis. Each week, Joan brings you news from inside the Vatican and the Church around the world, as well as interviews and answers to your questions. Now, here's the host of Vatican Insider, Joan Lewis.
Welcome to Vatican Insider on this first weekend of May. As you know, after the news highlights and the Q&A, I feature a guest in the interview segment. My guest this week is Jacob Stein, a native of Omaha, Nebraska, who is working on his licentiate in dogmatic theology at the Angelicum in Rome. He has a fascinating story and a passion he will share with you. That passion is called Crux Stationalis. Jacob will tell us about his favorite station churches in Rome and talk about his apostolate as a member of a Roman archconfraternity that helps the poor and needy and has a special devotion to care for pilgrims. So stay tuned for that. And now the news highlights of the week. Sunday, April 28th. The big story Sunday, of course, was Pope Francis's half-day visit to Venice as the Lagoon City hosts the 60th edition of the Venice Art Biennale. The first pope to ever visit the Biennale, he met female inmates at the Giudecca Women's Prison, Biennale artists, and young people. The Vatican Pavilion is housed in the Women's Prison. It's entitled With My Own Eyes and is dedicated to the theme of human rights and people living on the margins of society, seeking to draw the world's attention to them. Later, an estimated 10,000 people attended the papal mass at St. Mark's Square. Pope Francis also visited the saint's tomb in the basilica named for him. Venice has given three popes to the church, including Pius X and John Paul I, who died in 1978. Notwithstanding health and mobility issues, Pope Francis seemed energized during his five-hour visit, transported on land and sea by wheelchair, golf cart, and motor launch. At the women's prison, he greeted inmates, prison staff, security, and volunteers one by one. He highlighted the great difficulties of prison life, but also said that prison can offer a time for moral and physical rebirth. He also addressed Biennale artists in the Church of La Maddalena in the prison facility. And then there were some remarkable words to young people. Turn off the TV and open the gospel. Set aside your smartphone and encounter people. You are not a digital profile. You are children of God. Whenever you feel down, change perspective. The only time you should look down on others is because you are there to help them get up. We are beautiful and fragile, a bit like Venice. The Pope apologized for his lengthy speech, asking youth if they were bored. 1,500 young people shouted out, "No!" The Pope said, "Well then, you're being polite," and of course everybody laughed. Monday, April 29th. Pope Francis addressed the Canossian Sons of Charity, also known as the Canossian Fathers, and the Montfort Brothers of St. Gabriel as they gather for their respective general chapters. The Pope highlighted how general chapters are true moments of synodality and grace, to be lived first of all in docility to the action of the Holy Spirit, gratefully remembering the past, paying attention to the present in mutual listening, and in reading the signs of the times and looking to the future with an open and confident heart. Also Monday, the Holy See Press Office released the itinerary for Pope Francis's one-day pastoral visit to Verona on May 18th, the eve of Pentecost. He will meet with the local church, children, prisoners, and will celebrate Mass. Tuesday, April 30th, the Vatican released Pope Francis's prayer intention for the month of May, for the formation of men and women religious, and for seminarians. In his video message, Francis said every vocation is a diamond in the rough that needs to be polished, worked, and shaped on every side. He notes that a good priest, sister, or nun must above all be a man, a woman who is formed and shaped by the Lord's grace. These are people who are aware of their own limitations and who are willing to lead a life of prayer, of dedicated witness to the gospel. Wednesday, May 1st, Feast of St. Joseph the Worker, was a holiday in the Vatican, although Pope Francis did preside at the weekly general audience. In Italy, May 1st is Labor Day and a holiday throughout the country, as it is in about 80 nations around the world. The general audience took place in the Paul VI Hall instead of St. Peter's Square due to rain. Pope Francis focused on the virtue of faith, the first of the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity. Without the three theological virtues, he began, we would not have eyes that see even in the dark. We would not have a heart that loves even when it is not loved. We would not have a hope that dares against all hope. He held up Abraham, Moses, and especially the Virgin Mary as preeminent examples of faith-filled people. Faith, he said, is the happiest gift, the only virtue we are permitted to envy, precisely because it triggers grace in us and opens the mind to the mystery of God. At the end of the audience, the Holy Father expressed closeness to all those affected by the severe floods that have devastated Kenya. He also denounced the arms industry and those profiting from death as he prayed for victims of war in Ukraine, Palestine, Israel, and Myanmar. Thursday, May 2nd, Pope Francis sent a letter to parish priests taking part in the international meeting Parish Priests for the Synod, in which he underscored that the Church could not go on without their love, faith, and dedication. Some 300 parish priests from around the world gathered this week in Sacrofano outside of Rome for the five-day meeting dedicated to listening, prayer, and discernment to answer the question of how to be a local synodal church on mission. The meeting ended Thursday. Francis acknowledged the great diversity of the realities facing pastors, noting that bringing their diverse perspectives and experiences enriches the process of synodality. Parish priests, he insisted, know from within the life of God's people, including their joys, hardships, resources, and needs. For this reason, a synodal church needs its parish priests. He said that without priests, we will never be able to learn how to walk together and to set out on the path of synodality. Also Thursday, Pope Francis welcomed senior clergy from the Anglican Communion who were in Rome this week for the 2024 Primates Meeting, the first of its kind to be held in the Eternal City. He thanked the gathered bishops for having chosen Rome, the city of the Apostles Peter and Paul, as the location for their meeting this year, saying, I realize that the role of the Bishop of Rome is still a controversial and divisive issue among Christians. In fact, the primacy of the See of Peter is a point of division between Catholics and Anglicans. For this reason, said Francis, it is necessary to engage in a patient and fraternal dialogue on this subject, a dialogue which, leaving useless controversies behind, strives to understand how the Petrine ministry can develop as a service of love for all. Francis also stressed the need for a fruitful ecumenism. Also Thursday, the Holy Father welcomed to the Vatican King Abdullah II of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. The Pope has known him since the start of his pontificate. Their first meeting was in 2014 for the occasion of Pope Francis's apostolic journey to the Holy Land. After their conversation and greetings with the Jordanian delegation, there was the traditional exchange of gifts between the leaders. Friday, May 3rd, Pope Francis met with members of the Blanquerna Foundation at the Ramon Llull University in Barcelona, and he urged Catholic universities to provide education that helps people form their minds and hearts without seeking to create, quote, illusory replicas of impossible ideals. The Pope invited university professors to help students realize that even when they have achieved their goals, they still must strive for an encounter with the Lord and dedicate themselves fully to service of God. Also Friday, meeting with the National Vocational Training Confederation, CONFAP, Pope Francis encouraged the Italian Catholic Network to focus its attention on young people from disadvantaged backgrounds who are marginalized by the job market and feel rejected by society. Addressing some 6,000 members of CONFAP in the Paul VI Hall, Pope Francis warmly thanked them for their work, which he said, inspired by the social doctrine of the Church, provides a vital service to society, not only because they offer state-of-the-art courses, but most importantly, because they reserve special care and attention to disadvantaged and marginalized young people. Well, stay here for the Q&A and my talk with Jacob Stein about Crux Stationalis. Welcome to this week's Q&A. The question sent in via email is, what is the apostolic pardon? Well, I want to tell you, this is so important, I want you to listen closely. And if you have any questions, talk to your parish priest. The apostolic pardon is given as part of the last rites. The Handbook of Indulgences, number 28, says, quote, priests who minister the sacrament to the Christian faithful who are in a life and death situation must not neglect to impart to them the apostolic blessing with its attached indulgence. The apostolic pardon or blessing is an indulgence given in situations of danger of death, usually after the absolution of the sacrament of penance. The focus is on the remission of temporal punishment due to sin. One of the prayers a priest will say is, quote, by the authority which the apostolic see has given me, I grant you a full pardon and the remission of all your sins in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. But if a priest cannot be present, Holy Mother Church lovingly grants such persons who are rightly disposed a plenary indulgence to be obtained at the approach of death, provided they regularly prayed in some way during their lifetime. The use of a crucifix or cross is recommended in obtaining this plenary indulgence. In such a situation, the three usual conditions required in order to gain a plenary indulgence are substituted for by the condition, quote, provided they have regularly prayed in some way. I think you can gather from what I've just said that this is very, very important.
Discover the beauty, truth, and goodness of the Church. With the EWTN online learning series, you can delve into the riches of the faith and grow closer to the Lord with free videos and study guides. Enroll in the EWTN online learning series free courses today at learningseries.ewtn.com.
This is a Pro-Life Minute with doctors Stephen and Gracie Christie.
Okay, so pro-choicers say that an embryo might technically be alive, but so is an acorn or a tomato or a jellyfish, and we don't worry about those lives. Do you also fret over killing jellyfish?
Okay, a jellyfish or an acorn or a tomato is a thing. An embryo or a fetus is a human being, and all human beings, unlike things, have inherent dignity and immense intrinsic value, irrespective of their capacities. Surely you're not going to argue that all living things have equal intrinsic value, that there would be no difference between killing, for example, a two-year-old cow or a two-year-old child. Clearly, that's not the case. We simply do not kill innocent human beings.
For more on the culture of life, go to EWTN.com/pro-life.
Welcome back to Vatican Insider. Here's Joan Lewis.
Well, I want to welcome my listeners to another fascinating weekend with Vatican Insider. It's always fascinating because of my guests. And I have a guest you are going to love to listen to this weekend, Jacob Stein. And I'm going to welcome him right now. He's going to tell you about his studies in Rome. He's going to tell you about a site he's created and his very exciting work. So, Jacob, welcome.
Thank you, Joan, for having me. It's a great joy to be with you and to discuss this work in Rome as someone who lives here on the streets of Rome and has been here for quite some time. I've been here since 2015. And that was actually the second time I've been in Rome. I studied in Rome as a seminarian just for a semester abroad. And that introduced me to the city, to my university. Yeah. And then it's what brought me back again in 2015.
Well, I have to do full disclosure, and I told Jacob that I would be doing this. We first met at a dinner party at my home a year and a half ago, I guess it is now. And it was the dinner party to honor Cardinal Pell. The Cardinal and I had known each other for many years. He had been back in Rome after that terrible, tragic time of being unjustly imprisoned in Australia. He was back in Rome, and even if he wasn't a top news story of every day, he was at the top of anybody's agenda who wanted to know about the Vatican. A very well-bred, thoroughly delightful person who knew the Vatican inside and out. Certainly the finances, that was his area of interest. But my listeners know that I love to give dinner parties and bring people together. And so, of course, Father Joe, his secretary, was there, the cardinal. And then I said, bring three other guests. And dear Jacob Stein was one of those three guests. So Jacob, you're completing your licentiate. You have completed it.
I'm presently, I'm still completing my license in dogma and dogmatics at the Angelicum, the Dominican University in Rome.
How long is a licentiate? How many years, generally?
So typically it would be a two-year program. With all this work that I do in my own, we'll get to this, I'm sure, this topic. But with all this work and as a lay student in Rome, it can be a sort of a balancing act of managing your studies and your work and social life as well in Rome.
Oh, sure.
And so it's a two-year program, which follows upon 5 years of formation, 2 years of philosophy, then 3 years of a bachelor's in sacred theology, and then 2 years of this specialization in your own field within different right. theological sectors.
You are from Nebraska. Tell us about that, a little bit about your family, etc. growing up.
I grew up in Nebraska. My family is all in Nebraska. I'm the youngest of four children. We grew up in the church. Nebraska seems very far away from Rome, so I never would have thought that I would have lived in Rome when I was younger. But the first time I came to pilgrimage was in 2009. I was just about to enter seminary, and I came on a 12-day trip. And it was my first experience of the Eternal City, of Assisi, of Orvieto. And so I kind of I got hooked at that point. And then obviously Nebraska is my home, but Rome has become very much my second home. And so, as I said, I've been here since 2015.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, all roads lead to Rome. Which road brought you here? And you just told us. And I can remember, speaking of home, when I moved over here, my parents were living in Illinois. And for me, home, when I was here, was always where Mom and Dad were, where the family was, right? And then they retired to California, so California became home. And people would say to me, so Joan, where are you going on vacation? And I'd always say, home. And they'd say, but isn't Rome your home? And of course, then that's a whole topic, you know, over a glass of wine or something else like that. Tell us a little bit about the Angelicum, a university. I just love how it got its name.
Well, the name comes from St. Thomas himself, the angelic doctor, just in the purity of his doctrine, in the fact that he's such a giant in the way that he synthesized and systematized just all of the teachings of the church fathers from the fullness of revelation, which was handed down to us by the apostles. And that was something that even, it's interesting, I'm in a class just right now on his life, and you sort of experience how, where he was in different parts of his life, whether it was in Paris or Naples or Rome or Orvieto, and what he was studying and how that then formed his thought and developed his thought. And especially when he encountered the church fathers in such a full sense, when he was composing this...
The Summa?
The Catena Aria, actually.
Okay.
So the connection of all of the commentaries of the church fathers on the Gospels. So you're diving into the fruit of the Gospels with the wisdom of the church fathers. And that...
I would think that reading, even for someone who isn't doing it for study purposes or a degree, just reading Thomas Aquinas would be like being on a high.
Well, and he always helps us. He still helps us with providing clarity of terms, with providing a way to look at the world, at theology, at God himself.
Well, the proofs that he gave for, you know, there is a God. Mm-hmm. And here's the proof, by the way, folks.
And I think we have a great example. We would say that St. John Paul II isn't, properly speaking, a Thomistic theologian, but his great insistence upon faith and reason, and that there being no contradiction between the two, really finds itself in St. Thomas Aquinas with these five proofs, which are logical proofs,
exactly,
which carry through to the existence of God.
I think that's what I love. I'm a very logical person, And so when I read someone that I can fit into their scheme or they fit into mine, it's a great joy. So you're right, though. He was known as the Angelic Doctor, so the Angelicum, a nickname for the university, and an even shorter name is the Ange. You know, so Ange, yeah. So where are you studying? I'm studying at the Ange.
I'm studying A-N-G. At the Ange, yeah. Precisely.
Now, Jacob, you also have a Facebook page. Among the, you alluded to doing different things. I know you do translations. We're going to talk about your big work in just a minute. But your Facebook page says you work at freelance translator and editor. You were a sacristan here at Rome Parish, the Parroquia Santa Trinita de Pellegrini, the Holy Trinity of Pilgrims. So a little bit about each of those things.
I think we can go back to what I said about St. Thomas, about the different, where he was living, where the surroundings that he had really formed him. And I find that with myself. If I look back, I was able, when I first moved back to Rome in 2015, I was studying at the Angelicum. I was working as a sacristan at this parish, which is a parish historically which houses pilgrims and has a great apostolate,
yes,
for that reality. And we're coming on the Jubilee year. So all of these things resonate. And it's been all of these aspects have influenced how I've carried through my work with social media. I began with these translations and these editings of text in collaboration with different networks. And it pushed me, especially after the years of restrictions that we had, it pushed me to explore Rome kind of by myself and then to share what I was exploring with others, which brought me into more of the social media sphere and the development,
sure,
of my projects.
It has to be wonderful, though, to work in a parish. I mean, I just talked to some of the American seminarians, you know, who get, like at our parish, St. Patrick's, for Americans, who interact before they're even ordained, to interact with people, you get to know people, you get to know problems, things you might face, you know, as a priest, mm-hmm, and just to get to know a parish and its pastors. So, no, I just do want to say that if you happen to have just tuned in, I am talking with Jacob Stein, a theology student in Rome, and he's the author of our next big point, and actually the purpose of his sitting in my office today for this interview, and that's Crux Stationalis, C-R-U-X, Station, A-L-I-S,
yes.
Stationalis, all right? So now, we're going to get to the heart, the crux of the matter, and we want to talk about this amazing work of yours. Once somebody starts to visit Jacob on his site, you better have a good amount of free time because you are not going to let go. So tell us how this was born, what it is.
So Crux Stationalis, it means, in essence, station cross. And people tend to think of the stations of the cross with that. But actually, it alludes to a much more ancient tradition in Rome from the early centuries of the church, from the 4th, 5th century, where the local church of Rome, I'm sure your audience has heard about this a lot, but the Lenten Roman station churches.
Oh, yeah. I do a special show on that. Always in Lent, exactly.
So I took this name from what they used to do. They would gather at one church every day, and each different part of Rome would gather with their deacon of that area, who would be carrying a crux stationalis, a station cross, which was kept at St. Anastasia, which is a very, you know, connected to the imperial part of Rome. It sits right on the foot of the Palatine Hill. And there, so many precious relics were kept. Those crosses, but also the mantle of St. Joseph, the veil of Our Lady.
Right.
So it's there where they just had this great wealth of relics. And so they gather behind that cross. And I took that name, especially for this Lenten tradition, and so in a way to transport this tradition to our daily life. So I get to use social media where I explore each of these churches with segments of video, 6 minutes, 7 minutes, 10 minutes. In the end, it's 6 hours of video that I can take you through all of the churches of Rome.
Well, because it's 40 station churches.
Yeah.
And I think my readers and listeners know, because I've posted on my blog but also done radio show, that it's now the seminarians from the North American College, average Catholics, professors at universities, it can be ambassadors from different countries. They all meet at a certain church, you know, day one of week one is a certain church, and there's Mass at 7. And you become friends with all of these, mm-hmm, people. You might have coffee afterwards, but It's a wonderful thing, this coming together like they did eons ago.
And it was something which was nearly, it was a tradition which was lost in a way with the Avignon papacy, and then with the reunification of Italy and the restrictions on the church in Rome. And it wasn't until the Lateran Treaty came about in 1929 that then there was a greater freedom. But even then, it was one Monsignor, who was a great friend of the Pope, who resurrected this tradition. And but even then, it was John the 23rd who began again in the late 50s. I think it was 1959 was the first year that he went to Santa Sabina, which is the first Roman station church during Lent on Ash Wednesday. And the tradition has just been growing since then. And so we have, as you said, the North American college who goes there in the morning. I join the Romans in the evening. It was my way of, you know, being a foreigner in this city. This is my way of being most connected to the local church.
Oh, sure, the parishioners. And by the way, we must say, you mentioned relics a few minutes ago at St. Anastasia, but most of the churches have some important relic or two or five, and they kind of, sometimes they're in a back room and they're brought out just for Mass on the station day of that church.
Precisely. And in the evening, sometimes, or actually most every station church, we process, we sing the Litany of the Saints in a way which the morning Masses just don't allow, because the seminarians need to get there, and they need to get done, they need to get to universities.
Well, everybody's got to get to work or teaching or whatever.
But that means sometimes also the sermon in the evening can be quite long. So that's always adds to the sort of, as we'd say, the penitential nature of making
of Lent. Yes, right, so. Exactly. Well, that's all the time today with Jacob Stein. But come back next week when we look at his ministry, if you will, Crux Stationalis. He tells us about his favorite station churches and talks about a special apostolate he has as a member of a Roman archconfraternity that helps the poor and needy in Rome, and has a special devotion to care for pilgrims.
For more information on these stories, or to check out Joan's blog and to ask her a question, go to EWTN.com. That's EWTN.com. Thanks for listening to Vatican Insider on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.